Chapter 21. The strategy of putting all the Protoss in the center of the battle line, and all the Terran Marines, Reapers, and Mechs at the flanks, had worked out badly the first time Cruikshank and Alika had tried it. So naturally, they were trying it again. Which probably looked odd, especially since the Zerg were lining up for a massive killing blow. A group of Hydralisks had been gathered opposite the Protoss in a spearhead formation, with only a thin line of Zerglings stretched across the rest of the choke point to keep the Terrans busy. It was a good strategy, one that the history of this battle would suggest was a winner. Once the Hydralisks had cleared out all the Protoss, they could turn both Terran flanks and take them out. Cruikshank could only hope that the trick he and Alika had come up with would make the difference for the Allies. He frowned, his train of thought stumbling over the word. Allies. He'd never thought of the Dominion and the Protoss as having that kind of relationship. Never wanted to, either. Yes, they'd fought together on a few occasions, but that was a far cry from being actual allies. At least in Cruikshank's mind. Even after Emperor Valerian declared a ceasefire, Cruikshank had insisted on thinking of the Protoss less as friends than as not enemies. Fighting shoulder to shoulder with Protoss was a new and not entirely pleasant experience for him. Still, for all their arrogance and stiff-necked sense of superiority, he had to admit that Alika, at least, could be made to see reason. Sometimes, when there was no other choice.
"It has begun," Alika warned. "The pressure has been increased."
Cruikshank bared his teeth, and from the Warhound's cockpit he could see the entire center of the Protoss formation wavering as they took the full brunt of the Sialisks' psionic attack. Any minute now, and the Hydralisks would begin their charge.
"G5!"
he called into his comm. The man had a name, of course, but mech pilots came and went so quickly that it was easier just to think of them as Goliath 5. Even when the Goliath 5 mech itself was out of commission.
"We're ready, Colonel,"
Goliath 5 said.
"Well, I am anyway. The others are... well, I'm sure they're not actually drunk." "That's why you're there," Cruikshank said with a touch of grim satisfaction.
Alika hadn't liked this part of the plan, had hated it, in fact, but Cruikshank had insisted, and the Protoss had eventually given in, and he should now be damn glad that he had. Not that he would likely ever admit it.
"Get ready to fire on my signal. On my signal," he added just to make sure.
Goliath 5 was no more a fan of the Protoss than was Cruikshank himself.
"Roger that, Colonel."
"They approach," Alika said, his voice sounding even more strained.
Cruikshank looked across the field. The Hydralisk spearhead was on the move.
"Get ready, everyone," he called.
He glanced at his rear display, at the Phoenixes lying half-crushed in the middle of the field. Was it too late, he wondered, to pull the line behind them? Probably.
"Alika, get your people moving, now!"
For the first half-second, he thought that Alika had missed his order, or, worse, that the heightened buzzing in the Protoss's brains was drowning out everything else. Then, to his relief, the center of the battle line wavered and began to crumple. The Protoss loping or staggering to the flanks, running away to cower behind the Marines, Reapers, and Goliaths that were still standing against the enemy. Templar and Nerazim alike, caving before the psionic attack of the Sialisks and the threat of the oncoming Hydralisks. Cruikshank held his breath. This was the make-or-break moment. If the enemy had abandoned the idea of getting more Zerg to Point 3 and instead decided to annihilate the Terrans and Protoss, who had so inconveniently dedicated themselves to blocking their path, the Hydralisks would mirror the Protoss move and focus their attack on the flanks. But whoever was running the Sialisks still had their priority straight. Redoubling their speed, the Hydralisks arrowed straight for the wide gap that had opened up in front of them. Cruikshank could almost imagine the Zerg commander smiling at the victory, or at least coming as close to a smile as a Zerg could get. He took a deep breath.
"G5! Fire!"
And with a crackling sizzle and a blanket static charge that straightened every hair on Cruikshank's body,
one of the phoenixes lying helpless on the ground behind the battle line opened up with its ion cannons. Protoss ion cannons were designed for anti-aircraft and anti-spacecraft combat. Cruikshank had never seen one used on the ground. It was a sight he would not soon forget. The collimated pulse of negative ions blasted through the gap where the Protoss had been standing seconds earlier, the lower edge flash-charring the grass below it, the side edges tearing apart air molecules and throwing ripples of static charge across the Goliaths, Reapers, and Marines 100 meters away. And the Zerg, running straight into the center of the pulse, simply disintegrated. It was as awesome a sight as Cruikshank had ever witnessed. The Hydralisks didn't explode as with grenades, or throw off splashes of blood as with Gauss rifle spikes, or die in any of the usual ways Zerg did on the battlefield. They simply came apart, like pieces of dried grass in a fire. Their carapaces peeled away, their claws and teeth and faces blurred and shattered and became dust in the wind. They went neatly and in order, the ones in front blowing back into the ones behind, which then did the same. The first pulse made it all the way to the fourth file before it dissipated, and Cruikshank wondered briefly if the Zerg commander would try to pull the attackers back or at least disperse them. They did neither. But then, they really didn't have time. The first ion pulse had barely dissipated when Goliath 5 fired his next shot, taking out the remaining 3 files. The second shot was the last. Alika had warned that the damage to the Phoenix extended to the power system, and that the capacitors had only limited storage capability. But with the Hydralisks bunched together for a breakthrough, 2 shots were all Cruikshank needed. Even as the surviving Zerg reeled under the static charge after effects of the pulses, the Marines and the Goliaths opened fire from the ground while the Reapers added their own rain of hypersonic metal from above. A few of the Zerg reached the battle line, only to be slaughtered by the Protoss. And in the end, the Allies held the field.
"The psionic attack is fading,"
Alika announced into the new silence, his relief clearly evident in his mental voice.
"I believe the Psylisks are pulling back." "You want us to go after them, Colonel?"
Goliath 1 asked. Cruikshank eyed the forest, now devoid of visible Zerg. It was a tempting thought. But there could be anything still lurking in there. And while Goliaths were designed for maneuverability in tight quarters, even they had their limits.
"Stand down," he ordered. "Marines, pull back and regroup. Goliaths, keep an eye out for surprises. Reapers, hold altitude and log any movement. Alika, are your people okay?"
"They are," Alika said. "But for a time, they were unable to focus properly. Combat would have been disastrous."
"Even the Phoenix command crew?"
Cruikshank asked, perversely wanting the Protoss commander to say it out loud. To his surprise, Alika did.
"Even the command crew," he said. "Perhaps even especially the command crew. You were right to insist that a Terran handle the final aim and activation of the ion cannons."
And to Cruikshank's even greater surprise, Alika's admission didn't feel nearly as satisfying as he'd expected it to. Was he actually getting too old to gloat?
No, he was tired, that was all. Just tired. "I'm glad it worked," he said.
The yellow long-range comm light winked on and he tapped the switch.
"Cruikshank."
"Horner,"
the Admiral's voice came back. "Report."
"The field is ours, sir," Cruikshank said. "We've won the day."
"Congratulations," Horner said. "But the day's not over. How mobile are you?"
"We have 4 Goliaths and a Warhound in fair to decent condition."
"Any chance of repairing or freeing any of the ships?"
"No, sir. Not down here," Cruikshank said. "The warp fields still aren't working either."
He frowned, suddenly realizing where Horner was going with this.
"Hawkman's team?"
"Yes," Horner said. "The tree palisade's been knocked completely over. Abathur sent a devourer ramming into it, and there's a massive Zerg gathering outside."
"How long?"
"Probably not more than a few minutes."
Cruikshank mouthed a curse, and he and his force were 15 clicks away, with some serious terrain between here and there. A soldier in fully functional combat armor could handle that kind of distance with ease, but every one of his Marines and Reapers had sustained battle damage to either their armor, their body, or both.
"I'm sorry, Admiral," Cruikshank said, "but there's no way I can get enough of my force there in time to help."
"I know," Horner said heavily.
"Neither can we."
Across the field, Alika was checking out his people. Cruikshank stared at him.
"My force can't get there anyway, sir," he said. "But there might be another option."
For a long moment, no one said anything. That alone was surprising. Aaron would have expected at least some swearing, but for once, Whist and Diz were silent. Maybe there were situations so serious that they superseded even Marine and Reaper vocabularies. That was a frightening thought.
"What are we going to do?" she asked.
"You're going to get those samples," Whist said. "The rest of us are going to see what we can do to stop the Zerg.
Or at least slow them down," Diz added. Aaron looked at her sample tube.
"What good will it do to slow them down?"
"All the good in the world," Diz said. "For the first time since we landed on this damn planet, Aberthur's missed a bet." He pointed to the transmitter. "Like I said, if he uses this thing to talk to the Silasks, it means their psi doesn't block it." Aaron looked at the transmitter in sudden understanding.
"So once I've got my readings, we can send them to the Hyperion."
"Exactly," Whist said. "Ulavu, you think you can figure out how to work it?"
"It is of Zerg construction," he said doubtfully. "If it uses the same protocols as human Valkyrie comm systems, a Terran would likely be better equipped to understand it."
"Maybe," Whist said. "But Aaron's busy, and I need Diz and Tanya downstairs. So you're elected. Get in gear and figure it out."
He nodded toward the archway.
"Let's go see what they've got planned this time."
Aaron turned back to her work, her stomach knotting up. Getting their data to the Hyperion would be good. It might be the vital piece that would stop a war. But if it was, she would really like to be alive to see it. Blinking away thoughts of her own death, she got back to work. The return line from the pod was easy to spot. It was typical Zerg organic construction, with a sheathing that should be capable of self-repair. Mentally crossing her fingers, she eased a syringe through the tube and extracted a few drops. She then eased the needle out, watching another drop ooze out through the hole. But just one. The needle hole had indeed closed up. Puffing out a sigh of relief, she injected the drops into the compact bioanalyzer and started fastening the access panel back into place. From down the ramp came the staccato hiss of the Gauss rifle. The final battle had begun. She finished with the panel and stood up, too quickly, fighting for balance against the tank riding over her shoulder and hip. She caught her breath. The tank. The flamethrower. And Whist and Diz had completely forgotten she had it. She glanced at Ulavu still fiddling with the transmitter. For a second, she was tempted to toss a sample tube to him and tell him to scoop out some cells from the nearest Silasque carcass. But he was busy, and that was her job anyway. After loping across the chamber, she found one of the Silasques Ulavu's warp disc had eviscerated, pulled a few cells and fluids from three different areas, injected them into the bioanalyzer's secondary port, and headed for the archway. She paused at the second landing, craning her neck to peer over the barrier. Whist, Diz, and Tanya were below her on the bottom landing, firing down the ramp toward the entrance. She headed down, rounded the barrier, and peered between Whist and Tanya. The tree palisade had been knocked down all right, though she couldn't see what had been thrown against it. Clambering up and over the shattered lumber were dozens of Zerglings, Banelings, and Hydralisks, all clearly determined to get over the barricade and charge into the defender's fire. And the Zerg were winning. Whist was no longer firing bursts with the same abandon he'd shown earlier in the mission, and he was clearly working hard to conserve his waning ammunition supply. Diz was doing the same. Tanya's face was pinched with strain as she torched enemy after enemy after enemy.
Aaron smiled tightly. Well, Abathur and the Siolisks had a surprise coming. Fumbling with the flamethrower's nozzle, she finally got it unhooked from the tank. She stepped forward and tapped Whist on the arm. Whist! He glanced over his shoulder.
You finished?
Yes, Aaron said, wincing. Even in the last couple of seconds, the Zerg had gained another meter of territory. The forward line of carcasses now extended 2 or 3 meters beyond the ends of the trees, and the group climbing over the blockage behind them was pressing even closer.
I brought you a present, she said, holding out the nozzle grip. I think you forgot we had it.
Didn't forget, Whist grunted. Can't use it.
Aaron blinked.
Why not?
Because we'd be shooting downhill, Whist said, firing off another burst from his Gauss rifle. That means a lot of the heat would come straight back at us. Our armor can't handle that.
I thought you used these things in combat.
Firebats use them, Whist said. Marines and undamaged CMCs sometimes do.
He gestured to the gaping slits in his own armor.
Marines and damaged CMCs don't. Crazy as it might seem, we prefer getting sliced up by Zerg to getting barbecued alive. It's faster, and it hurts less.
Aaron looked at Tanya and Diz, wincing as she spotted the slashes and cuts and openings in their armor. Ulavu, without any armor at all, was out of the question, which left only one possibility.
Fine, she said. Show me how it works.
Whist looked up again.
What?
Show me how it works, she repeated. My armor isn't damaged, remember? I'll do it. Just show me how.
You'll be alone, Whist pointed out. Once you open up, we'll have to retreat.
She hadn't thought about that aspect, but it made sense. It also didn't matter. However it had to work, it had to be done. Tanya might have been reading her mind. Maybe she was.
You don't have to do this, she called over the gunfire. Abathur has to run out of Zerg sooner or later. Just show me how the damn thing works, Aaron snarled. I'm scared enough, all right? Just get me started before it's too late.
I've got it, Diz said, holstering his Gauss pistol and stepping to Aaron's side.
For once, Aaron noted distantly, there was none of the snarky sense of humor that always seemed to be simmering beneath his surface.
I use things like this all the time. Okay, here's the flow control, here's the ignite trigger. Full range is about 30 meters. Effective flash cooking range for a Zerg is 5 to 10.
The weapon wasn't too complicated. All too soon, she was ready.
Okay, she said, unclipping her bioanalyzer and handing it to Tanya. Here. The preliminary analysis should be finished. You can send it to the Hyperion as soon as Ulavu has the transmitter working. I'll get as far down as I can before I start.
We'll stay and back you up as long as we can, Whist said. Good luck.
She was halfway down the ramp when a pair of Zerglings managed to slip through the barrage coming from the landing and charged. Reflexively, she ducked to the side, her fingers fumbling for the controls Diz had shown her. The nozzle grip vibrated subtly as the fuel surged through it. And abruptly, a roiling cloud of brilliant blue-white flame blasted across her vision. It washed across both of the attacking Zerg, and she caught a glimpse of their carapaces charring in midair before they shot past, out of sight. She released the trigger, shaking with adrenaline reaction. No matter how many times Zerg charged at her, no matter how close they came or how far back they stayed, each time was just as terrifying as the very first attack outside Point One. But there was no time for introspection. Even with just a single shot, the temperature inside her armor had risen noticeably. Whist hadn't been kidding about that. A few more shots, and even her fully intact armor might start to break down. More Zerg were coming at her. She ignited the nozzle again, spraying fire like water from a garden hose over the whole line. Another line leaped off the inner edge of the trees, and she again swept it with fire. Most of the Zerg died with a single blast, but a few had to be given a second shot in order to take them down. She continued forward. Step, spray. Step, spray. Step, dodge, spray. Sometimes, one of the creatures got past her, and she could only hope that it was too injured to bother her, or that one of the others would deal with it. If they were still there. Her helmet had a rear display, but the smoke was swirling so thickly around her that she couldn't see anything back there. Even in front, it sometimes took a quick burst of flame to blast away the smoke long enough for her to see where the latest threat was coming from. Diz had shown her where the fuel level indicator was, but she didn't dare take her eyes away from the battle long enough to look at it. If she ran out, but she couldn't think that way. Her plan depended on her reaching the entrance with a good deal of reserves left over. Because she did have a plan. It might not be a good plan, but it was all she had. In the meantime, all she could do was step, fire, step, fire, step, fire. It was almost a shock when she reached the bottom of the ramp and started across the entry cave itself. The smoke was getting thicker now, and the inside of her armor was becoming uncomfortably hot. She wondered how hot the outer neosteel shell was, and how much insulation her undersuit could provide. The CMC's cooling system was whining with the strain, and she suspected it wouldn't last much longer. Her mind flashed back to Wist's comment about being barbecued alive. Distantly, she wondered what that would feel like. Then suddenly, she was there. Around her were mounds of charred Zerg carcasses, enough to make it difficult to walk. 10 meters in front of her was the entrance to the cave. And heaped in front of the entrance was a tangled mass of wrecked and shattered trees, the biggest stack of kindling she would ever see. Raising her aim, kicking the flow control all the way over, she fired. There was another line of Zerg coming over the trees. They stumbled and reared back and died under her assault. A fresh wave of smoke rolled over her, and she shot off another blast to clear it away, to find that the world's biggest mass of kindling had now become the world's biggest bonfire. "There you go," she muttered, taking a step backward. She gave the trees one more burst of flame, just to clear away the smoke and to confirm that no Zerg were going to get through that anytime soon. "Choke on it!" She turned, and peering through the smoke as she tried to weave her way through the maze of stinking carcasses, she headed back for the ramp. She had made it to the first landing and was halfway to the second when she realized that the acrid smell of burnt flesh wasn't coming from the charred Zerg at all. It was coming from her. She would never remember afterward how she made it the rest of the way up. She remembered crying out for help but hearing no answer. Certainly no one loomed out of the smoke to offer aid. She remembered calling again, then realizing that the heat and fire had likely burned off her comm antenna and charred the transmitter. She remembered the fear that that might not be the case, that the lack of response was because her friends were already dead. She remembered putting one foot in front of the other, the stench in her nostrils bringing her to the edge of vomiting, trying desperately to pop the catches of the armor that was rapidly killing her, but not recalling how they worked. She remembered coming around one of the landings and seeing the wavering forms of Wist, Diz, and Tanya finally appear through the smoke. She remembered a silent scream for help echoing through her mind and falling, and the agony as new parts of her body pressed up against the burning neo-steel of her coffin-sized prison. She remembered being laid on the floor and Ulavu's face appearing over her, and she remembered a sudden wash of coolness and a lungful of incredibly chilly air. And then for a time, she remembered nothing at all.
Chapter 22. "Couple of second-degree burns," Wist muttered as he carefully cut off Aaron's undersuit. "Mostly at joints. Bad one at the left shoulder. No third degrees I can see."
"Thank God," Tanya said, trying to see through the smoke rapidly filling the chamber. She hadn't seen what Aaron had done down there. The heat from the flamethrower had become too intense for any of the rest of them, but from the sound and smell, she guessed the trees of the former palisade were now on fire. It was a good plan, certainly a good temporary one. A barrier like that would be intimidating to even the most determined Zerg, and quickly fatal to most of them. On the downside, the cavern's entire air supply was now rapidly turning opaque and nearly unbreathable. And of course, Eventually the fire would die down. They should have brought the rest of the Gauss rifle spikes from the damaged magazines, she realized. Despite Wist's deriding of the idea, it looked like they would have had time to reload.
A hell of a lot of first-degree ones, though, Wist continued. Diz?
Here, Diz said, handing over a small field tube of burn spray. That one's Aaron's. Go ahead and use it up. I've got mine ready.
Wist grunted thanks and began to apply the salve. She's lucky we got her out of that armor in time. Another minute and this would have been a lot worse.
Yes, Tanya murmured. We.
Fine. He got her out, Wist growled at her. I already said thank you.
Yes, you did, Tanya said, looking over at Aaron's armor. Or rather, at the pieces of her armor, which were all that were left after Ulavu cut the red-hot metal off her with quick and surgically precise slashes from his warp blades. He'd probably saved her life. He'd certainly saved her from months of pain and reconstructive skin surgery. He deserved more than just a distracted thank you. But for now, that would have to do. She looked up, frowning. Ulavu had cut Aaron free and had helped the others get her out of the suit. But after that, he disappeared, not staying around to help them carry her the rest of the way up the ramp and into the Adastra chamber. Had the heat and smoke rising from the fire below driven him away? Probably. Unlike the others, he wasn't wearing any barrier to their increasingly hostile environment. Moving farther into the Adastra chamber would be about all he could do. Of course, Aaron wasn't wearing armor anymore either. When she regained consciousness, her whole body would be screaming in agony as hot air pressed against burnt flesh. Maybe when Wist was done with the salve, he could give her something to make sure she stayed asleep. So where was Ulavu anyway? Tanya peered through the smoky gloom, finally spotted him standing by the Zerg transmitter. She'd given him Aaron's analyzer earlier. Was he sending the data to the Hyperion? Or was it simply that the area near the duct was the only source of cool, fresh air he could find? Ulavu, are you all right? She thought toward him. I am unharmed, his reassuring thought came back. Tanya frowned. There was reassurance in his tone, but also something more. Excitement? What is it? What's going on? Come, he said. All of you, come and see.
Next. Wist said, tossing aside the empty tube of salve.
Here, Diz said, holding it out. Before you start, Tanya said, Ulavu wants us to join him over by the transmitter.
Whatever it is, it can wait, Wist said. She needs this now.
I think that's his point, Tanya said. The air underneath that vent has to be better than what's coming up from below.
She's right, Wist, Diz said. Here, you can keep treating her skin while Tanya and I carry her.
Wist hissed.
Fine. Just watch that shoulder when you pick her up.
It was tricky, but they managed it. Maybe just in time, too. Even asleep, Aaron's breathing was becoming labored. Briefly, Tanya wondered if her CMC's air system could be salvaged, or if it was even functional anymore. They reached the transmitter to find Ulavu standing over it.
So, is the air better here?
Wist asked, as Diz and Tanya gently laid Aaron on the floor. It is better, Ulavu said. But I did not invite you here only for that. Behold. He pointed up toward the hole. And right on cue, an arm-sized chunk of rock tumbled out of the opening and fell with a muted crash onto the floor.
What the hell?
Diz said as he twitched backward. They are enlarging the opening, Ulavu said. He stretched out one foot and swept the piece of rock to the side, and Tanya saw now that there was a growing pile of similar shards over there. Very soon, we will be able to escape this chamber.
Who's enlarging it?
Wist demanded, looking cautiously up at the hole. My people, Ulavu said, and there was no mistaking the pride in his voice. The Protoss, who fought beside Colonel Abram Cruikshank to protect us from the Zerg returning from the Terran Psi emitter trap.
Ah, them, Wist said. Not that Abathur didn't have plenty more Zerg here in the neighborhood to work with.
Quiet, Tanya admonished him. However many Zerg he had, this way he didn't have more.
I suppose, Wist said.
When the opening is large enough, they will take Dr. Aaron Weiland to the top of the mesa, Ulavu said, ignoring the exchange. Then, you will all be brought up, and we will protect you until more aid arrives.
Tanya looked at Wist, expecting another less than gracious comment. But the sergeant remained silent. Maybe he was finally remembering the state their armor and weaponry were in.
Thank you, Ulavu, she said. From all of us. We are glad to render you aid.
More rock chunks were falling from the hole now, almost faster than Ulavu could sweep them out of the way. A bright but somewhat muted glow appeared, the same color as Ulavu's warp blades. The glow grew brighter and sharper. And with the last slicing of the rock around the opening, a dark Templar dropped through and landed on the floor. He gave a quick, appraising look at each of them, then turned to face Ulavu. Tanya had the sense of a private conversation taking place.
This is Alika, Ulavu said. He and the others have run far to render aid to us. He is prepared now to bring Dr. Aaron Weiland to the top.
Good, Wist said. I don't suppose they have any medical equipment with them.
No, a new Protoss voice echoed through Tanya's brain. But fresh Dominion air vehicles are en route and will arrive within a quarter hour. Will she survive until then? After all this work, she damn well better, Wist said. Good enough. You have any rope up there?
In answer, a coil of slender line unrolled itself through the hole.
You know Terran physiology best, Alika said. You will fasten the line for maximum safety to her.
Thanks, Wist said dryly, taking the end of the line and crouching beside Aaron. I was going to do that anyway. Tanya, you don't need that visor and hood, do you?
Not as much as she does, Tanya said, popping her visor and handing it over. The hood was a bit trickier, but she was able to get it off. It wouldn't protect Aaron's head against bumps as well as a full helmet, but at least it would be something. The air in the chamber was even hotter and smokier than she'd realized, and she found herself blinking back tears as the smoke and ash assaulted her eyes. Wist got the visor and hood on Aaron, and Tanya adjusted the air supply controls while he went back to his rope tying. A minute later, everything was ready. At a silent order from Alika, the Protoss on top of the mesa began pulling, easing Aaron's unconscious form up into the hole. Tanya winced as her head brushed the edge, but as long as the bump stayed small, the hood should absorb most of the impact.
They will be careful, Ulavu assured her.
They'd better, she warned. She doesn't need any new injuries.
I agree.
He paused, and Tanya could sense a sudden new attentiveness.
Something odd has happened.
Uh-oh, Diz said. You hear that?
Tanya strained her ears.
No.
Exactly, he said, drawing his P-45. The big bonfire outside has stopped.
Tanya frowned. He was right. The distant background roar had disappeared.
We'd better check it out.
Hang on, Wist said, watching as Aaron's legs disappeared into the hole. I'll come with you.
You stay, Ulavu said, stepping past him toward Tanya and Diz. Guard and protect her, and work further on the transmitter. I will go.
The silence seemed to grow deeper as Diz led the way along the corridor and down the ramp. Tanya fought to keep her vision clear of the smoke and her own tears, wondering how her power would work if she could barely see her target. Not very well, she suspected. Diz had his Gauss pistol ready, but Tanya had no idea how many rounds he had left. Not many. Only Ulavu with his warp blades had any serious hope of stopping the next wave of Zerg, and he had to wait until he was in range of their claws and teeth before he could fight back. Except for his warp disk, anyway. But even that could only be used once before someone had to go retrieve it. And suddenly, it clicked. Someone to retrieve it.
The warp disk, she said to Ulavu. Is that why you came to the Ghost Program to look for a Teek?
That is correct, Ulavu confirmed. You understand now how Inarazim's control of void energies, combined with a telekinetic's ability to maneuver the disk within a group of enemies, would create a powerful combat unit. I hoped to experiment with Terran telekinetics to learn what innovations they could bring to the disk's operation.
Definitely sounds interesting, Tanya said, but why keep it secret? This is the sort of thing military planners love to work with.
Ulavu was silent another few steps.
Because Terrans and Protoss are perhaps no longer enemies, but neither are we fully allies, he said reluctantly. We are vastly different peoples, Tanya Caulfield, and I fear that much work must be done before we can build a truly close relationship. It was thought best that you not yet know of this weapon or of our research in this direction, lest you misunderstand our intentions or motivations.
I understand, Tanya said, but I don't think Emperor Valerian would take it wrong. He seems to be an honorable man.
Yet beings of honor may still disagree, sometimes to the point of war.
Tanya wrinkled her nose, wishing she could argue with him, knowing she couldn't.
We'll keep your secret, was all she could think to say.
Can you speak for the others? He asked.
At any rate, such a promise is as yet premature. There is still a strong possibility that we will all die before this day is over.
Boy, it's a mess down here, Diz murmured. Can you two even see well enough to fight?
We're okay, Tanya assured him, hoping it wasn't a complete lie.
They wouldn't know for sure until the first Zerg appeared around the landing below and charged up the ramp toward them. And the Sialisks hadn't given up either. She could still feel a low-level buzz in the back of her brain. Presumably, they were gathering whatever was left of their forces for a final surge. But if they were, they were taking their sweet time about it. 10 steps from the bottom landing and still nothing.
Speaking of fighting, where are they anyway?
Good question, Diz said. Weird. Is the air out there getting clearer?
Tanya shook her head. I can't tell.
It is, Ulavu confirmed, seeming as puzzled as Diz. I hear a new sound, but I cannot identify it.
Me neither, Diz said. They reached the landing, and he paused long enough to check the indicator on his Gauss pistol. Let's find out, shall we?
Visibly bracing himself, he stepped around the corner of the landing. Blinking, Tanya followed, to find herself facing an extraordinary sight. The bonfire Aaron had ignited in the downed palisade trees was indeed out, but it had only gone out because a solid blanket of Zerg was now covering it, smothering the flames, and leaving only a few wisps of rising smoke to show where the conflagration had been. Inside the cave, lined up in front of the smoldering trees, were a dozen Zerg of a type Tanya had never seen before. They had the same general giant wasp form as Mutalisks, but were smaller and had larger grasping claws and wider wings. The wings were apparently what was making the unfamiliar sound as the Zerg beat them furiously toward the entrance, forcing out the smoke-filled air. And standing a few meters inside their line, overseeing the operation, was a Zerg broodmother.
Well, that's something you don't see every day, Diz murmured.
What, a broodmother? Tanya asked, blinking furiously. The air was definitely starting to clear, but she was still seeing the world through a layer of tears.
I mean the Zerg fanning out the cavern, Diz said. They're not armored.
Tanya squinted. She'd missed that part entirely. But he was right. Unlike every other Zerg she'd ever seen, these seemed to have only a rugged, leathery skin instead of the usual interlocked bony plates. Their conversation had apparently caught the broodmother's attention.
Ah! She said in a gravelly psionic voice as she turned to face them. My apologies for the lateness of my arrival. I am relieved to find you alive.
For the moment, anyway, Diz said. That question's always a little up in the air. Who are you, may I ask?
The broodmother bowed her head and torso.
I am Overqueen Zagara.
Tanya swallowed hard, her swimming vision blurring even more. over Queen Zagara, the heir and successor to Sarah Kerrigan, the most powerful ghost humanity had ever produced. Here was the Zerg who had brought the Dominion and Protoss to this crossroads of war and peace, and who even now held that balance and hope in her claws. If she had come here for Tanya.
"I feared that the unknown creatures you have been battling would overwhelm you," Zagara continued. "I thus traveled here in the hope that my presence would wrest control back from them."
"It seems to have worked," Diz said. "Thank you, Over Queen. Assuming those are your Zerg that put out the fire, and not the Sialisk's associates."
"They are mine," Zagara said. "These are also my Skirlings that I have set to clear the smoke, that you may once again have clean air."
"Skirlings, huh?" Diz said. "Interesting design. A new breed, I assume?"
"Yes," Zagara said. "They were created by Abathur, at my command, to one day carry the Adastra when they are fully grown."
"To where?" Diz asked.
"To wherever they must be."
Zagara paused, and Tanya could sense the Over Queen's mix of fear and anger.
"The Adastra within the growth chamber. Do they yet live?"
"As far as I know," Diz said, "we certainly didn't do anything to them. Let me call and... You know, why don't you just come up and see for yourself?" Tanya felt Ulavu stir beside her. To deliberately invite the Zerg Over Queen behind what was left of their defensive position? But Ulavu said nothing, and Tanya likewise kept silent, and after a moment, Zagara lifted a clawed limb.
"I will," she declared, starting across the floor. "Do not fear. My Zerg will stay under my control."
"Good," Diz said grimly, "because I'm guessing there are still some Sialisks hanging around. Tanya?" "Yes, they're still there," Tanya confirmed. "Still hoping they can make us wipe out the Adastra for them."
"Or hoping to kill us and pin it on the Over Queen," Diz said. "Wist, you getting all this?"
There was a pause. Reflexively, Tanya reached for her volume control, only then remembering that her comm was currently on Eren's head. "What does he say?"
"He says he's getting it," Diz relayed. "He doesn't believe it, but he's getting it. Anyway, we're bringing her up," he continued. "If I were you, Wist, I'd try real hard to have that transmitter up and running by the time we get there."
He smiled tightly at Tanya.
"Emperor Valerian is going to love this."
Over Queen Zagara then confirmed that these are the Adastra she created, Lieutenant Hawkman said, concluding his report. "Or at least, these are the pods that Abathur said the Adastra would be grown in. Without opening one of them, she can't tell for sure."
"And she refuses to open one,"
Artanis's voice came over the bridge speaker.
"She doesn't refuse, exactly, Hierarch Artanis," Halkman said. "But she points out that appearances can be deceiving. And, even with a closer look and a smell test, she might not be able to confirm that these are what she asked him to make. She said our analysis would be much more definitive."
Valerian looked over at the biolab status display.
"They're starting the tests now," he told Hawkman. "They say both samples Dr. Weiland took look good and should give good results."
He checked another display.
"Sickbay also reports that Dr. Weiland herself has arrived, and they're getting to work on her burns."
"Thank you for letting us know, Emperor," Hawkman said, sounding relieved. "One last thing. Over Queen Zagara confirms that this is a version of the transmitter Abathur made for her. Probably why she was able to get it working so easily. She has no idea how many more he might have made on the side, and I think that brings us up to date."
"Yet the account is not complete," Artanis said darkly. "Where are the Sialisks? How did they come to exist? Are there more? Where is Evolution Master Abathur, and will Over Queen Zagara allow him to be brought to us for questioning? Most important, are the Adastra truly the creatures Over Queen Zagara claims, or are they wrapped in yet more lies and manipulations?"
"I do not lie, Hierarch Artanis,"
Zagara's voice came from the speaker, heavy with dignity and suppressed anger.
I have acted in full good faith throughout our encounters. I can only repeat that my good faith efforts continue. I have left the protection of my conference structure in order to aid the Dominion survey team. I have located Siolisk carcasses, confirming their existence, and sent them to you for study. I have sacrificed many of the swarm to extinguish the fire and bring the survey team to safety. I have ordered my broodmothers to remain within their spire centers, and the leviathans that they summoned to remain on the ground.
Such goodwill may be merely fear of our fury, Artanis said. We will not soon forget the battle that cost the lives of Templar and Narazim alike.
That battle was initiated and driven by the Siolisks.
So you say, Artanis said. We have heard enough words. We need now to hear some evidence.
You have the evidence of the Siolisk carcasses and the report of the survey team.
Neither of which gives proof of the perpetrator or intent, Artanis countered. I repeat my question. Where is Abathur?
I do not know, Zagara said. I allow him to go where he will, subject to my command. Furthermore, I refuse to believe the evil you charge him with. Abathur is the Evolution Master, eldest of all living Zerg. His loyalty is to the Swarm.
Then whence come the Siolisks? Artanis demanded.
I do not know, Zagara said again.
If I may interpose my thoughts, Valerian said quickly. To him it was obvious that Abathur was manipulating this mess, though the Evolution Master's motivations were still murky. But Artanis and Zagara were at a horn-locked stalemate, and nothing was going to budge either of them. Nothing but absolute, objective proof. And the only way to get that proof was to drag Abathur out into the open and persuade him to talk, which might be harder than it looked. Valerian assumed he had to answer Zagara's summons, but there was a lot about the interaction between Overqueen and Evolution Master that he didn't understand. If Zagara refused to call him, or if Abathur refused to come when she called, Valerian frowned as an odd thought suddenly struck him. To come when called. Artanis and Zagara had gone silent. Valerian had interrupted their argument and they were waiting for him to say his piece. He had one shot at this. He had better make it work.
We've had long-distance communications like this one, he said, improvising as he went, hoping his brain could stay ahead of his words. We've had face-to-face conversations in Zerg territory. I think it's time, Overqueen Zagara, for you to speak with us in Dominion territory.
I will not travel to Korhal 4, Zagara said flatly.
I'm not asking you to, Valerian hastened to assure her. But I would very much like to speak with you aboard the Hyperion. Am I correct in assuming that your personal Leviathan is the one in which Mukov came to me to deliver your plea for help?
It is.
Then may I ask you to summon it to Point 3, Valerian said. I would humbly request that you board it in the company of the remaining members of my survey team and join me for a conversation. There was a short silence.
Your request is strange, Emperor Valerian, Zagara said at last. I see no purpose to it.
The purpose is peace, Valerian said. I believe that if you will grant me this request, we can together establish the proof that Hierarch Artanis requires. Another silence. Valerian mentally crossed his fingers.
Very well, Emperor Valerian, Zagara said. I will summon my Leviathan.
Thank you, Overqueen Zagara, Valerian said. One final request. A moment in private with my survey team? An even longer silence.
Very well, Emperor Valerian, Zagara said again. I will return outside to await my Leviathan.
Matt reached over and tapped the mute button.
With all due respect, Valerian, this plan is nuts, he said in a low voice. Bringing her aboard the Hyperion is begging for trouble.
Don't worry, she won't be coming aboard, Valerian said.
Hierarch Artanis, are you still there?
I am, Artanis said. I, too, have objections. If you seek to imprison or destroy her as a way of blunting the Swarm's ability to make war, it will have only limited effect.
Be assured I have no intention of doing either, Valerian said, tapping the mute key. Lieutenant Halkman, has Zagara left?
Yes, Emperor, she has, Halkman said.
Is the Sialisk interference gone?
Let me check. Yes, Emperor, they seem to have pulled back.
Good. I need you to close down the Zerk transmitter and shift to your suit's long range.
One moment.
There was a brief pause, followed by the muted sound of sustained Gauss pistol fire.
Okay. The Zerk transmitter is off the air, Halkman said, a bit dryly.
Valerian felt his lip twitch. Still, with alien constructs, that was probably the only way to be absolutely sure.
Admiral?
Zerg transmission off at this end, Matt confirmed.
Valerian nodded.
Lieutenant, you still there?
Affirmative, Emperor, Halkman said.
And you, Hierarch Artanis?
I am.
All right, Valerian said. All of you, listen carefully. Let's assume that everything Zagara has told us is the truth, and that all the survey team's speculations are also true. That gives us the theory that Abathur created the Adastra as life-nurturing beings under Zagara's orders, then siphoned off some of the Zelnaga essence on his own and melded it with Zerg genetics to make his new psionic-powered Sialisks.
Perhaps at Over Queen Zagara's direction, Artanis said.
Again, let's assume for the moment that she's not involved, Valerian said. Let's further assume that Abathur has been manipulating the situation from the start, trying to get us to destroy the Adastra so as to poison our conversations and goad Zagara into restarting the war.
All right, Matt said. So where do all the assumptions and logic take us?
To the two questions we've all been wondering about, Valerian said. One, if Abathur is manipulating things, what's his endgame? And two, where is he now?
We've tried scanning, but there's just too much surface area down there, Matt said. And, given the Zerg penchant for digging massive tunnel systems, he could be anywhere on the planet.
Actually, I don't think so, Valerian said. At least part of his endgame has to be getting safely off Gist. He's hardly going to precipitate a war with him stuck on the planet in the center of the gun sights. Given that these Sialisks have to be part of his long-term plan for Zerg victory, he must also have held back a number of them to take off the planet with him. That means he has to be planning to commandeer a Leviathan.
Of which there are 7 on the surface, Artanis said.
Correct, Valerian said. But I think I can narrow it down. Do you remember, Hierarch Artanis, what Zagara said when we first arrived? She greeted us and then thanked me specifically for coming so quickly. And she was right, we did arrive more quickly than we otherwise might have. Admiral Horner, do you remember why we were so prompt?
Because you were intrigued by Mukov's message, sir, Matt said, sounding puzzled. Because the hope of peace was something you thought worth pursuing.
Yes, of course, Valerian said. But both reasons would have brought us here eventually. Why did we come so quickly?
Matt looked at him sharply.
Because Mukov wouldn't give us any details about the situation, he said. She just repeated the same bare-bones invitation over and over.
And what would have happened if she had been more talkative?
We'd have brought her down for more detailed questioning, Matt said grimly. He was on the same page now. And we would have taken a good, hard look at her Leviathan.
A moment, Artanis said. Are you suggesting that Abathur and his Sialisks are aboard that particular Leviathan?
It's the perfect hiding place, Valerian told him. We've seen it, we've done a cursory flyby, and everything we've seen indicates it's harmless.
It's a quirk of Terran psychology, Hierarch Artanis, Matt explained. If you're planning a crime, you make a point of walking past the police officer on duty,
because drawing attention to yourself gives the impression that you have nothing to hide.
Exactly, Valerian said. That also means that if that Leviathan takes off, it'll be the one we least suspect that he'll be aboard.
He lifted a finger as another piece fell into place. Also, we know now from the survey team's discovery that whoever controls the Siolisks does so via commands delivered through one of those biomechanical transmitters, possibly commands that are pitched too high for humans or Protoss to hear. Dr. Kogan's team has already found high-frequency capability in the Siolisk carcass Zagara sent us. We also know Mukov has the same kind of transmitter aboard her Leviathan, because that's how she first contacted us. That was how Abathur could listen in on the battles at the focal points and direct the Siolisks.
Yet, if he was already safely off the planet, why would he come back?
Artanis asked, still sounding unconvinced.
I can answer that one, Hierarch Artanis, Hawkman put in. As Emperor Valerian said, he needed to be here to watch over the situation, make sure we all played the parts he had planned for us, and fine-tune the script if we went off book.
Which still raises the question of how an evolution master became that good at strategy, Valerian said. We still need to figure that one out.
Maybe he did a little work on himself between Siolisks, Matt suggested. Or on Mukov. He could hardly sneak his Siolisks aboard without her knowing, so she would have to be in on it with him.
And adding enhanced tactical ability to a queen would be harder to spot than adding it to himself, Valerian said as the pieces fell together. Anyway, Abathur was in the conference structure during the attack at Point One, so he couldn't have run that one himself.
So Mukov is the brains, and he's the one who made her that way, Matt asked.
However it works, we can sort it out once we have him, Valerian said. Right now, we need to draw him into the open. That's why I told Zagara to bring the Leviathan to Point Three. I want to get our people aboard without arousing suspicion.
That assumes Abathur won't simply ignore Zagara's summons and stay put, Matt warned.
He won't, Valerian assured him. Remember, we set all this up using a transmitter he can tap into. As far as he knows, we're handing him the perfect opportunity to get a jump start on his escape. With his Leviathan already in space, he can get out from under most of our weapons without any suspicion or resistance on our part.
And if Zagara is with him when he runs, it'll make her look equally guilty, Hawkman pointed out.
Which would fit perfectly with his overall plan, Valerian said. So, once you're aboard, Lieutenant, your mission will be to locate Abathur and detain him.
Understood, Emperor, Hawkman said. And the same with any Siolisks we find?
I recommend their destruction, Artanis said.
I agree, Valerian said, a message on one of the displays catching his eye. Speaking of which, he added, keying the biolab into the circuit, Dr. Kogan has just come up with some numbers for you.
Dr. Kogan?
Thank you, Emperor.
Kogan's voice came over the speaker.
Okay, these are preliminary numbers, so don't lean too hard on them. We've done an initial workup on the Siolisk, including a first-order attempt to sort out the percentages of Zelnaga and non-Zelnaga. It's always hard to tell with unfamiliar species, but by comparing their genetics to the Adastra sample Dr. Weiland sent, and taking into account the number of Siolisks already killed...
Dr. Kogan, Valerian prompted.
Sorry, Emperor. Bottom line, we estimate Abathur could still have anywhere from 300 to 500 Siolisks to play with.
Of which most will be aboard the Leviathan, I assume, Hawkman asked.
Probably, Valerian said, wincing. That was a lot of Siolisks for 3 Terrans and a Protoss civilian to take on. Artanis was obviously thinking the same thing.
You will need assistance, he said. I will send a phalanx of warriors to accompany you.
With all due respect, Hierarch Artanis, I don't think that would be a good idea, Hawkman warned. Zagara is supposed to be a willing passenger on a harmless Leviathan. If we throw in a whole bunch of extra troops, Protoss or Dominion, Abathur may smell a rat and take off.
And we will shoot him out of the sky, Artanis said darkly.
If we do that, we'll never learn the full truth, Valerian said.
Lieutenant?
I think we can handle it, Emperor, Hawkman said. But we're going to need new armor and weapons. A fresh jump pack would be useful, too.
I'll switch you over to the quartermaster, Valerian said. And if we don't speak again before you board the Leviathan, Lieutenant, good luck.
Thank you, Emperor, Halkman said.
Transferring you now, Matt said and keyed the control.
The indicator light from the comm winked out.
I do not agree with this plan, Emperor Valerian, Artanis said. It is fraught with uncertainty and risk. If you are wrong, and if Over Queen Zagara's goal is to bring a Leviathan into our midst, we will find ourselves embroiled in battle in a position of terrible weakness.
I know it's dangerous, Hierarch Artanis, Valerian said carefully. Surely Artanis wasn't going to pull out of this now. But I think it's the only way to know for sure.
And if I refuse to assist, if I now draw the Protoss forces away, and leave you to face Zagara and her Leviathan alone.
Matt was watching him very closely. Then the Dominion will stand alone, Valerian said. But before you answer, allow me to remind you of some history.
What sort of history?
The only history that matters, Valerian said. The history between the Terrans and the Protoss. You remember Chao Sara?
On the display, Artanis's skin was going mottled.
Yes,
he said, his voice very alien.
You remember what the Protoss did to those colonists, Valerian said. The modeling was a sign of intense emotion, and the distant thought struck him that he was pushing the Hierarch pretty hard. He didn't care. You remember that there was a faction of the Confederacy, and later the Dominion, that was all for wiping the entire Protoss race out of existence, he continued. Do you remember why that goal was abandoned? Artanis didn't answer.
Because a man named Jim Raynor made a decision, Valerian said. He decided to trust the Protoss executor Tassadar, and therefore your people. That was the turning point, the start of the path that's led us here.
And you wish me to make that same leap of trust?
Raynor had plenty of evidence that the Protoss weren't to be trusted, Valerian said. But he listened to Tassadar's story and his version of the Protoss's reasoning and decided to take a chance. Right now, we're standing in the same place he was. We've seen the devastation the Zerg can cause, and yet we hear Zagara tell us that she and the Swarm have changed. I'm willing to take that leap of trust. Are you?
He gestured to the planet below them. If my plan fails and we can't resolve this, there may be war. But if we don't even try, there will be war. For a moment, Artanis was silent.
Do you remember what you said to me on the planet? That the Protoss were a noble race that served as guardians for many other species. Do you remember what I said in return?
That it was easy to stand above others when the Kala bound you together, Valerian murmured.
I have been thinking further, Artanis said. Perhaps nobility and honor were never meant to be easy. Perhaps there was always to be risk involved, and perhaps there can be no nobility without trust.
He drew himself up.
The Protoss struck first before Emperor Valerian on Chao Sara. That action cost many lives across the years, and even now is a poison between our peoples. I will not again attack first. Not here, not now. I will follow your path and trust in your judgment. And the Protoss will regain our nobility.
You never lost it, Valerian assured him quietly. Thank you, Hierarch. Whether we rise or fall today, we will stand together.
Artanis inclined his head.
I will await your word.
His image vanished from the display. Well, Valerian said, turning to Matt. It's up to the team now.
Yes, it is. Matt hesitated. You don't expect them to survive, do you?
Valerian sighed. Probably not, he said.
No, they're very likely going to their deaths. Or worse, I may be sending Tanya Caulfield straight into the hands of the Zerg's evolution master, with all the horrific consequences that implies. But if they can prove that Abathur is there and get him to admit his part, we may yet defuse the crisis.
And you're going to accomplish this how?
By letting Abathur think he's won, Valerian said.
Get me the quartermaster.
I have an order of my own for him.
Chapter 23. Tanya had always known Leviathans were big. Everyone knew that. The creatures were huge, in fact, bigger than Dominion battlecruisers or Protoss carriers. But it wasn't until now, walking up to one lying angled across a set of hills, that she fully appreciated how huge they really were. And they were supposed to find a single evolution master and a bunch of Psylisks and all that? As usual, Whist had had an answer.
You just need to think like a Marine, he'd assured her as the four of them had prepared to leave the Adastra Cavern, very likely for the last time. Don't worry about finding the enemy. Odds are, the enemy will find you.
It had not, in Tanya's opinion, been a particularly encouraging thought.
Tanya Caulfield, Ulavu's thought came. Are you all right?
Just a little nervous, she assured him. Ulavu was walking on the far side of Zagara from Tanya, the two of them flanking the Overqueen, while Whist took the lead and Diz took the rear. It was probably supposed to look as if the four of them were escorting a prisoner, though from a purely tactical perspective, their positioning was incredibly stupid. Their only hope was that Zagara truly wanted peace and was willing to go to extraordinary lengths to achieve it. They were already seriously pushing that commitment. Valerian had forbidden them to tell Zagara the truth about what was going on, lest Abathur get wind of it through the Zerg's psionic connection. And the Overqueen was none too pleased with the travel arrangement. Even without Tanya's limited teep power, she would have been able to tell that Zagara was bristling with the indignity that had been foisted on her. Luckily, she apparently wanted to avoid war even more than she wanted to preserve her dignity. What she would think and do when she learned how she'd been manipulated was anyone's guess. Tanya wasn't looking forward to that. At least they were all as well equipped as possible for the imminent meeting. A dropship had delivered a new CMC-powered combat suit for Whist, replacing his battle-worn one, along with a new Gauss rifle and all the ammo magazines he could carry. Diz had similarly been brought new Reaper armor and a fresh jump pack. Tanya herself had been given a full helmet to replace the ghost visor she'd left with Aaron, plus a new canister rifle courtesy of Emperor Valerian himself. The rifle was all for show. Hopefully, Abathur wouldn't realize that until it was too late. Ulavu, as the civilian everyone aboard the Hyperion still thought he was, had been offered a return trip aboard the dropship. He'd refused, citing the possible need for more insight on Zerg and Zerg mentality. Tanya was still not sure how she felt about him and his long deception, but for the moment, she was just happy to have him at her side. Still, against a Leviathan holding up to 500 Psylisks, three Terrans and a Protoss were a pretty pathetic showing. Hopefully, Abathur would think so too. There were several sphincter-type openings visible in the Leviathan's thick hide, she saw as they approached, each leading into a dark, ribbed tunnel. Whist looked back at Zagara, who silently indicated one of them, and the group headed inside. The tunnel they found themselves in had a very different feel from that of the Adastra chambers. There, the general sense had been one of space, even airiness. Here, everything was much closer, verging on claustrophobic. Every surface was pockmarked with nooks and crannies, making footing difficult, and there were a multitude of smaller tunnels and ducts that headed off at random places and in random directions. The group was quickly forced into single file, with Whist and Tanya leading the way, Zagara in the middle, and Ulavu and Diz behind her. And unlike the Adastra chambers, once they moved out of view of the sunlight outside, the tunnel had no illumination except the beams from their own lights. Tanya kept her light tracking across the surfaces as they walked, peering tensely into each tunnel big enough to hold a Sialisk. If Abathur decided to pick them off on the way to the Leviathan's control center, this tunnel was the perfect place to do it. But no attack came. It was so quiet, in fact, that Tanya began to wonder if Emperor Valerian had been wrong about Abathur's plan. Valerian's theory was logical enough, but even logic was of limited use when some of the pieces were being filled in by guesswork. If Abathur wasn't aboard, or if he had been aboard but had already left, then they would be back where they had started. And logic and theories weren't going to keep Artanis from incinerating the planet.
They are here. Tanya felt her breath catch in her throat. Are you sure?
I can feel them, Ulavu confirmed.
You cannot?
No, Tanya said, her last wisps of doubt blowing away. If the Sialisks were here, surely Abathur was too.
Everyone stay sharp, Whist murmured.
They'd been walking another 10 minutes, and Tanya had started to feel her share of the brain buzz when she finally spotted a hint of dim light in the distance. The light grew stronger as they approached, and she sensed the subtle changes in Whist's mind and posture as he slipped into full combat mode. And then, suddenly, they were there. The tunnel made one final sharp turn and opened into a chamber at least half again as big as the main Adastra caverns inside the mesas. Whist stepped inside, breaking to his right. Tanya followed, taking the cue and breaking to the left. Visually, the chamber was like a roomier version of the tunnel they'd just left. Like the tunnel, the chamber had walls that flowed into floor and ceiling without any hard edges or sharp breaks, and there was the same sort of texturing and multitude of side tunnels. Standing motionless near the entrance, watching as the group filed in, was a Zerg queen, her body shape and limb arrangement subtly different from Zagara's. Set into the wall near her was a duplicate of the transmitter they dug out of the Point 3 ceiling. And standing in the center of the chamber, instantly recognizable from the pictures Valerian had sent, was Abathur. Behind Tanya, Zagara stepped into the chamber and came to an abrupt halt.
Abathur?
The Zerg, Abathur, gesticulated with his smaller inner limbs. Tanya could feel something at the very edge of her mind.
Hold it, Diz said. I know you're surprised to see him over Queen Zagara, but let's not forget you have guests. Let's have a conversation.
What do you do here?
Zagara's demand pounded against Tanya's mind like a winter rain, and she was barely able to get out of the way as the Over Queen strode past, her eyes blazing, her limbs stretched out and poised to slash and tear, heading straight at Abathur. The Evolution Master flinched once, then stood his ground.
Abathur does what is necessary for Swarm, he replied. You betray the Swarm, Zagara insisted.
She continued toward him, and for a moment Tanya thought she was going to physically run him down. Instead, she stopped just in front of him, her limbs held high, her claws twitching as if they were trying to go for the Evolution Master on their own. Once again, Abathur held his ground, even in the face of the clearly furious Over Queen. Maybe, Tanya thought, he had more courage than she'd realized. Or maybe, he simply knew that he had the upper hand.
Over Queen Zagara speaks of treachery, the other queen spoke up, taking a step toward the group. I am Mukov. I will speak their words.
Thanks, but we've got it, Diz said.
Yet the nuances may escape you,
Mukov said, taking another step toward them.
I will stand ready to interpret.
No explanation owed,
Abathur said to Zagara, his mental voice grating and insolent.
But explanation will give.
Do so,
Zagara ordered, and Tanya had the sudden mental picture of a tightly coiled spring. The Overqueen was just barely restraining herself.
Swarm supreme, Abathur said. Swarm unique. Meant from beginning. Will be again.
The swarm will always be unique, Zagara said. You give no justification for betrayal.
Did not betray, swarm,
Abathur insisted.
Betrayed only betrayer.
Who is this betrayer?
Abathur's claws twitched.
Overqueen. Overqueen is betrayer.
How can she betray the swarm? Diz asked. She's the Overqueen. Anything she does is by definition the will of the swarm. Both Zerg ignored him. For a moment, the mental confrontation degenerated from understandable words into images, emotions, and sensations that spun by too quickly for Tanya to keep up. All she could sift out of it was that Abathur was defiant and unapologetic, and Zagara was furious and ready to rip him apart with her bare claws. What she didn't know was that Abathur had a hole card. Slowly, Tanya sent her gaze around the room, peering into each of the darkened tunnels as best she could. Unfortunately, all of them had the same twisty curves as the one the group had entered by, which meant there could be Sialisks lurking unseen in every one of them. Hey, Abathur, Diz called, trying one more time to get in on the conversation. We're on Overqueen Zagara's side here. How about explaining it so that the rest of us can understand? Abathur looked past Zagara, and it seemed to Tanya that his multiple eyes were measuring Diz.
Terrans owed no explanation, he said, but Abathur will give.
Good, Diz said. Let's hear it.
Swarm supreme, Abathur said. Swarm unique. Meant from very beginning. Will be again.
Yes, we got that part, Diz said. So what? You can't be unique without wiping out everything else?
Inferior species cannot understand, swarm,
Abathur said, his mental voice heavy with contempt.
Swarm supreme. Swarm meant to fill universe. Swarm meant to assimilate all, discard what not needed.
He says that the swarm was meant to assimilate all, Mukov said.
Tanya glanced over, noting with surprise that the queen was considerably closer than she'd been when the conversation started. Apparently, she'd been moving toward the group while she acted as a self-appointed translator. Should they be letting her get that close? Tanya looked at Diz and Whist, but both were focused on the drama taking place across the chamber. Maybe they hadn't even noticed Mukov's approach.
Thanks, but I'd like to hear this from Evolution Master Abathur himself, Diz said to Mukov. So you say the swarm is supreme, Abathur?
Swarm must grow. Change, Abathur said. Without war, can do neither.
So are the Sialisks the Zerg's next step toward starting another war? Diz called.
Cheetah, not Zerg,
Abathur said, his psionic voice a growl.
Swarm essence must dominate. Swarm essence not dominant in Cheetah. Swarm and Zelnaga essence equal.
Aha, Diz said, nodding. So that's your problem. Equal partnership isn't what you're used to, is it?
No matter. Cheetah not Zerg, but Cheetah Zerg weapon. We'll give Swarm victory over Protoss.
Abathur jabbed a claw toward Ulavu.
I don't know, Diz said doubtfully. Sialisks are tricky enough to fight, but they die easier than the Hydralisk that you based them on. But again, isn't it cheating to use Zelnaga essence? Doesn't that make it a Zelnaga victory, not a Zerg victory?
Victory not important, Abathur said. Perfection important. Swarm on path to perfection.
Unless you've already left that path, Diz said, or been passed by, maybe it's the Adastra that are perfection.
Adastra, Abathur uttered the word like a curse. Abomination.
How can they be an abomination, Diz asked. You created them, didn't you?
Zagara created abomination,
Abathur retorted, this time jabbing his claw towards Zagara.
Abathur, merely tool.
What's so wrong with them? Diz pressed. How did the Adastra take anything away from the Zerg?
Zerg manipulate essence, Abathur said stiffly. Zerg create new life, new purpose in others. Zerg drive evolution, mold into image of swarm. Do not give that power to alien beings.
The Adastra deal only with plant life, Zagara said.
She was clearly still furious. Tanya could tell, but at least she had calmed down enough to use intelligible words again.
They do not intrude upon the swarm.
Do not? Abathur countered. Zagara ordered that power be given to Adastra. Ordered Adastra not be absorbed into swarm.
The power was in the Zelnaga essence, Zagara insisted. That gift was not given to us to be absorbed into the swarm.
Zagara's promise to Queen of Blades, Abathur said darkly. Foolish promise.
So you wanted the Adastra destroyed, Diz said. But not just destroyed, you wanted us, Terrans and Protoss, to destroy them. That way your own hands would be clean and over Queen Zagara would have no one to blame but us.
Path of war out of Swarm's claws, Abathur said. Zagara, Abathur does not name Overqueen, is summoned by Terrans and Protoss. Acceptance is further betrayal of Swarm.
So how does it play out from here? Diz pressed. You're going to kill us anyway, so it can't hurt to show how clever you've been.
Cleverness does not matter, Abathur ground out. Only Swarm matters. Leviathan has left Gist. Leviathan will flee. Terrans and Protoss will name Zagara betrayer. Terrans and Protoss will attack Swarm. Swarm will respond. Swarm will again be at war.
Good plan, Diz said. But not going to work. They won't attack because they'll know that you kidnapped over Queen Zagara.
How? Abathur scoffed. Cannot speak truth to Terrans and Protoss. Inferior species will have only evidence of eyes and prejudice of thoughts.
See, that's where you're wrong, Diz said. It's true our long-range comms won't work with your Silasks present, but there are other ways. Ulavu, for example, is a Protoss, and Protoss have a form of the same psionic communication as the Zerg.
Protoss communication also blocked by Teetha, Abathur said.
I don't think so, Diz said. You see, we noticed how every time a Protoss force landed on Gist, you made sure to hit their transport in the right place to knock out the psionic boosters. The Protoss may be the primary target for Silasc Psi attacks, but those attacks don't interfere with their communication. In fact, Ulavu's been relaying this entire conversation to his people.
Lies,
Abathur said, his green eyes focusing on Ulavu.
Terran underestimates Abathur. Have studied full depth of Protoss psionic communication. No reach, distance covered, he gestured. No size and volume of psionic booster that can reach across such distances. Protoss does not carry.
You're right, he doesn't, Tanya spoke up. She hefted her canister rifle. Or rather, the psionic booster that Valerian and the Protoss Tex had built in the shape of a canister rifle. But I do. Abathur froze, his eyes on Tanya. So you see, there's really no point in maintaining this charade, Diz said. Let's go back to Gist and we can... With a wordless cry, Ulavu dropped to his knees. Tanya took a step toward him and staggered back, a scream boiling up in her throat as a blaze of agony exploded through her brain. And in that second, Mukov leaped across the remaining distance between them and attacked. Her first slash caught Wist across the back of his helmet and cooling unit, throwing him 5 meters across the floor. Diz spun around, dodged just a shade too slow, and took her second slash across his chest plate. He pinwheeled, nearly losing his balance, and then shot up into the air,
spinning and jinking like an injured bird as he tried to get some distance. Mukov slashed again, just catching the heel of his boot and nearly bringing him down. He recovered enough to keep from crashing and twisted back toward her, firing a shot from his Gauss pistol that missed completely. She took one final, useless swipe at him, then turned toward Tanya and Ulavu. There was nothing Tanya could do. Her brain was throbbing too hard to focus her power, her vision blurring too much, her armor too thin to block the claw when it came down in the killing blow. She tried to back up, knew she'd never get out of the way in time, and twitched violently as a blaze of green cut across her field of view. Ulavu had thrown his warp disc. Not as accurately as he might have wanted, she realized instantly. Instead of slicing through Mukov's body, the spinning void energy merely chopped off the limb poised above Tanya. But it was enough. Mukov screamed in agony and rage as the limb went flying. She turned reflexively toward Ulavu, raising her remaining slashing limb to strike, and staggered as Whist, still lying on his back, opened up with his C-14. For a pair of heartbeats, she jerked and twitched as the spikes hammered into her, trying to line up a shot at Ulavu, but unable to regain her stability long enough to strike. From somewhere above Tanya came a new scream, this one in her ears instead of her mind, a long, piercing mechanical sound, and Tanya felt the pressure in her brain ease a little. Whist kept firing, his spikes chipping away at Mukov's armor plating. The queen turned from Ulavu, abandoning that attack, and started toward the marine. There was a new double flash of green, and Mukov slumped over and collapsed to the floor. Tanya blinked away some of the blurring to see Ulavu lying beside the dead queen's abdomen. Even dazed by the Sialisk attack, he'd retained enough focus and control to roll half beneath Mukov as she turned toward Whist and stab his warp blades into her underside. Whist sent another two bursts into the queen just to be sure.
Tanya,
he called, his voice strained and oddly slurred. We're okay, she called back, shaking her head and blinking against the mental interference still pressing against her mind. Turning from Mukov's carcass, she looked across the room. It was as bad as she could have guessed. Worse. Zagara and Abathur were embroiled in direct personal combat, their limbs slashing at each other like ancient swordsmen in battle. Zagara was bigger and angrier, but Abathur was holding his own. And he had allies. Boiling out of every tunnel was wave after wave of Sialisks. It didn't matter that Abathur's scheme had been laid bare, not to him. All that mattered was that the Zerg returned to what they had once been, that they regained the power to follow their genetic imperative, to twist and mold other beings with ruthless efficiency, and then to join those beings to the swarm, the power to grow and change and continue down the path toward perfection, even if perfection was never achieved. The only one who stood in the way of that return to glory was Zagara. If she died, whether or not the Dominion and Protoss knew what had happened, the swarm would eventually return to its original nature and he would have achieved his goal. He and Mukov had planned this well. They had Zagara, they had position, and they had overwhelming numbers. What they hadn't counted on was that Zagara would have a few numbers of her own. So far, Diz was the only one in action, hovering above and behind Zagara and firing methodically at the lines of Sialisks streaming toward the combatants, firing at them and hopefully confusing them. The long scream earlier that had shaken away some of Tanya's mental fog, a scream that had gone quieter but hadn't faded completely, was coming from the turbo micro screen in Diz's jump pack, a special edition he'd asked for after Dr. Kogan's suggestion that Abathur might communicate with his Sialisks via ultrasonics. It seemed to be working too, at least to a degree. The Sialisks were moving slower than usual, slower than they had under the influence of the team's Psyblocks alone. A few of the creatures paused as they came into the chamber, as if waiting for orders that never came. But confusing them wouldn't be enough.
There were just too many of them, and only one Diz. And there was really no fine-tuning Abathur needed to do anyway. The Sialisks already knew what they were supposed to do. Diz would probably survive, the morbid thought drifted through the tangle that was Tanya's mind as she watched him soar up there above the conflict. She and Whist might survive back here by the entrance. They could make a run for it if necessary and find a choke point where they could make a stand until Valerian could send a dropship. For Ulavu, there was no such question or distant hope. Ulavu was going to die. Tanya had been right earlier. Abathur hadn't realized until now that Ulavu was a Narazim warrior, and his response to that revelation had been to hit the Protoss with as hard a psionic attack as the Evolution Master could manage. There was no defense against that assault. Ulavu couldn't hide behind a hail of hypersonic 8mm spikes. He couldn't escape by flying to the ceiling. The pressure on Tanya's own mind was tearing away at her soul. How much more of Abathur's assault was being dumped on the hated Protoss? Maybe Ulavu's mind was tougher than Tanya knew, but she'd seen that mind. She'd been as close to Ulavu as any Terran had ever been. He was strong, certainly, but he wasn't that strong. His presence here had ruined Abathur's plan, and Abathur would have his revenge. Ulavu had lied to Tanya. He'd betrayed her trust and their friendship, but he'd also saved her life. And sometimes broken friendships could be healed. Could theirs? Tanya had no idea. The pain was still too fresh, too deep. Even if it healed, it might leave a scar that would never go away. But ultimately, it didn't matter. This wasn't for friendship. This was because Ulavu was part of her team, and she was a ghost, a soldier of the Dominion, and her job was to protect him to the fullest of her ability, no matter what the cost. Ghost implants were there for a reason. Ghosts were unstable wild cards, some with known limits to their power, some without, some with known limits to their emotional stability, some without. Tanya had no idea what her limits were. She had no idea what would happen without the implant. Time to find out. Stretching out with her power, aware that she was literally playing with fire, she reached inward, raising the temperature at the center of the implant just high enough to burn out its core electronics. She had the sense of nearby brain cells burning and growing dark, the sense of the implant failing, the sense of a slave whose chains had suddenly been stripped off. Through the black swirls of Abathur's psionic attack and the red haze of her own righteous fury, she stretched out her power, and the Sialisks began to die. Slowly at first, just one at a time, then more quickly with two or three falling as she stared her rage at them. Then suddenly, they were falling in waves, toppling to the floor together like smoldering cordwood, their limbs flailing helplessly against the unseen attack that was destroying them from the inside. They died as they charged across the chamber, died as they emerged ready for combat, died even while they were still inside the tunnels. Through it all, Tanya seemed to float above them, her body stretching out to fill the chamber, her mind full of alien thoughts and chatterings and agony. Distantly, she was aware that her hands were pressed against the floor, but there was no sensation of touch or smell or hearing. All was mind. All was sight. All was alien. All was death. It was a massacre. Terrible and wonderful and horrifically satisfying. Tanya swept the room with hidden fire, burning some of the enemy even past the point of death, just because she could. Distantly, she sensed Abathur trying desperately to call for a retreat, but his orders were unheard and unheeded through the blanketing noise from Diz's jump pack. The buzz in Tanya's head began to fade, and the stutter from Whist's Gauss rifle began to slow. The haze faded into numbness. Vaguely, she wondered why she was staring at the arching roof of the Leviathan chamber. And then, Diz was kneeling over her, his expression tense.
You okay? He asked. Tanya, talk to me.
I'm okay, she breathed. Were her hands shaking? They were. So was her entire body.
Come on, he said, slipping a hand under her shoulders. We've reached the Hyperion, and there's a dropship coming alongside. We need to get you to sick bay.
Wait, she said as he lifted her off the floor. Ulavu, where's Ulavu?
He's fine, Diz said, and for the first time, Tanya noticed the oddness to his voice. Just a little shaky. Wist's helping him down the tunnel.
Okay.
Tanya eased back to her feet, clutching at Diz's arms as the compartment again swayed around her. Dead Silasks were everywhere, she saw with a flicker of guilt. Creatures who had just been doing as they'd been ordered.
What about Zagara? She asked, as Diz walked her toward the tunnel. Did she win?
Oh, she won and a half, Diz confirmed. You should have seen it.
I was a little distracted.
Yeah, Diz said grimly. Well, I only saw a queen fight once during the war. It was pretty vicious. This fight left that one in the dust. They were going at it like they were trying to rip each other down by molecular layers. For a while, Abathur was throwing Silasks at her too, just literally making them leap onto her back or torso and dig in.
Is she all right?
Seems to be, Diz said. Luckily, our little jump pack modification kept him from grabbing anyone except the Silasks closest to him, and Wist and I were able to blast enough of them off her to keep the attack at a level she could handle. It was probably distracting as hell, though. And then suddenly, he shook his head. There must have been some tipping point with how many Silasks Abathur had left to hit her with, because suddenly, she was tearing into him like a mulcher on a stump.
Did she kill him?
I don't think so, Diz said. But she came damn close. He looked like a dish rag when she dragged him out of here.
But she didn't kill him?
Tanya said, just making sure she'd heard him right. And you and Wist didn't either? Oh, we were more than ready, Diz said grimly. But Zagara told us not to. She said he was one of a kind, and that the swarm needs an evolution master to survive.
Why?
She didn't say, and we didn't ask, Diz said. She was hauling him out, and Crookshank had dropships and fighters on the way. He waved a hand. Anyway, that's way above my rank level. She and Valerian and probably Artanis can hash that one out.
I suppose, Tanya said. What happened to the rest of the Silasks? Was Zagara able to control them?
Diz hesitated. Actually, by the time she finished knocking the stuffing out of them, they were pretty much all dead.
Tanya swallowed hard.
Me? Well, you had help, Diz said. He was trying to be his usual flippant self, she could tell. But for once, it wasn't working. Anyway, if you feel ready to move, we need to get you aboard the Hyperion and start fixing whatever happened to you.
Yes.
Tanya hesitated.
Diz? Did I scare you back there?
Diz pursed his lips.
Truthfully? Truthfully.
Yes, he conceded. I think you scared all of us.
That seems fair, Tanya murmured.
The tunnel was starting to fade around her.
I think I'm going to need to be carried.
No problem, Diz assured her, shifting his grip. Just relax. Sleep if you need to. Why does it seem fair?
I didn't want to be the only one, Tanya said.
Her voice was fading away, even as the tunnel was going completely black.
Because I bloody well scared myself.
Chapter 24.
There she goes, Matt commented. Valerian nodded, watching the Leviathan pull away from its close orbit and head back toward Gist's surface.
There they go, he corrected.
Yeah, Matt muttered something under his breath. I don't like it. Leaving him alive is not a good idea.
Zagara says the swarm needs him, Valerian reminded him.
But she won't tell us why.
Which doesn't mean it's not true, Valerian said,
As long as he's under her control, and she claims he is, it seems to me we need to give her the benefit of the doubt.
Except that he hates her.
Valerian had to smile at that one.
How many years did you hate me?
That's different, Matt insisted. And I never really hated you, I just didn't trust you.
Of course, so much better.
Whatever you say, Matt said. Speaking of trust, you may have noticed that Artanis' purifier beam is still powered up. Powered up, and no doubt still targeting the .3 Adastra chamber.
I will not again attack first, the Hierarch had said earlier. Had he truly meant it?
Trust isn't an easy commodity to come by these days, Valerian murmured. I'm hoping he's simply making sure he's ready for a quick second shot if Zagara delivers the first.
Or making sure she knows he can deliver the first shot if he wants to, Matt said. He's heard the evidence and the arguments. Now he has to make up his own mind.
I suppose you're right, Valerian conceded.
Well, he's made the right choices up to now. All we can do is hope he keeps it up.
He cocked an eye at Matt.
So, how did I do?
There were moments, Matt said. But in the end, you came through okay.
Thanks, Valerian said ruefully. It's amazing how the proper and righteous path is so much easier to follow when you don't have the power to leave it.
Welcome to the world of absolute power, Matt said. Near absolute, anyway. Luckily, you have people around who can help nudge you back on the path if you start veering off.
I appreciate it. Valerian took a deep breath.
In the meantime, the Dominion still has serious problems to deal with. We'll give Zagara time to get back to Gist, and Artanis time to do whatever stand down he wants to do, and then see if either or both of them are up to another conversation.
The doctors had warned Tanya that walking might be tricky for a while, as her brain tried to rewire itself around the neurons she'd destroyed when she fried her implant. But for the moment, at least, she had an arm to lean on. For the moment.
I hear you're going back, she commented.
Yes, Ulavu said. Hierarch Artanis believes that the events on Gist have raised the Dominion's awareness of my presence, and that it will no longer be possible for me to remain with the Ghost program in my previously unnoticed position. More urgently, my true identity will soon be made known, followed closely by recriminations and feelings of betrayal. He hesitated.
You are yourself aware of the damage such feelings can cause.
I am, Tanya conceded, feeling a twinge of resentment deep within her. But it's not necessarily certain that your identity will be discovered. I've discussed it with Whist and the others, and everyone's agreed to keep your part of the mission out of their reports.
Ulavu turned to her, and she could sense his surprise.
You spoke to them on my behalf, after my betrayal of your trust.
Tanya shrugged.
We were a team. A team supposed to look out for each other.
I am humbled, Ulavu said.
Thank you.
Don't thank me yet, Tanya warned. It's still possible that someone will find a way to dig something out of those scrambled suit recorders. If they do, all bets are off.
I nevertheless appreciate your faithfulness, Ulavu said. I am both humbled and shamed.
Tanya sighed. I understand why you did it, Ulavu. I don't hold it against you.
Thank you, Tanya Caulfield. I am more grateful for your forgiveness than you can imagine.
Hey!
Colonel Cruikshank's voice called from behind them.
You, Protoss, hold it.
Tanya jerked, the sudden movement briefly intensifying her chronic shaking. Ulavu was ready, catching her arm with his other hand, bringing her back on balance and sending reassurance and strength through her thoughts. They stopped in an orderly fashion and Ulavu carefully turned them around. Cruikshank strode up to them, a controlled thundercloud of an expression on his face.
I was just in sickbay looking at Dr. Wyland, he said. First-degree burns over most of her body. Were you responsible for that?
Tanya opened her mouth, closed it again as Ulavu squeezed her arm warningly.
Why do you think it was I?
I'll take that as a yes, Cruikshank growled.
And the answer is because you're a civilian who had no business being on a military mission in the first place. You screwed up, and Weiland paid for it. Tell me I'm wrong.
He was with us at Emperor Valerian's request, Tanya reminded him frostily.
Which just goes to show that even emperors shouldn't get everything they want, Cruikshank retorted. They tell me you're leaving with Artanis and the main Protoss force, so I can't do anything about this. Fine. But be very sure that I will never again willingly allow civilians to serve alongside my people.
He focused on Tanya.
That goes for you, too.
Tanya shook her head.
I don't think so.
Why not? Because you have your own special dispensation from the Emperor?
Because I've applied to be reinstated into the Ghost Program.
Because...
Cruikshank broke off, his eyes widening.
You're joking. I thought you just talked your way out.
Well, I'm talking my way back in, Tanya said.
Why?
Tanya shrugged. This was my first mission. It turns out, I like them. For a moment, Cruikshank just stared at her.
Great.
He growled at last.
Fine. Means someday I might have you under my command again. I can hardly wait.
With a final glare at Ulavu, he turned and stalked away.
I thought you'd learned your lesson about lying to people, Tanya said reproachfully as Ulavu turned them around again and they continued on their way. Why did you let him think you caused Aaron's burns?
I did not lie, Ulavu corrected her mildly. In truth, Dr. Aaron Weiland's first-degree burns are indeed due to my actions.
Because without you and your warp blades, they'd have been third-degree burns?
My statement is still truthful, Ulavu said. If Colonel Abram Cruikshank draws an incorrect conclusion, that is not my doing. You did not tell me you were returning to the Ghost Program.
Tanya shrugged.
I have to, she said. You still want to recruit a Teek to help with the Protoss warp disk program, remember? You can't do it anymore, so I will.
I appreciate your willingness, Tanya Caulfield, but it is not your responsibility.
It is if I choose it, and I choose it. Reaching up a trembling hand, she squeezed his arm. Because helping each other is what friends do.
The officer's bar on the Hyperion was strictly off-limits to Marine sergeants. It was possibly off-limits to Reapers, too, officers or otherwise. As far as Whist could tell, Diz didn't give a damn about that. Whist himself certainly didn't. Luckily, no one else in the bar seemed inclined to challenge them on the point. Maybe it was the massive bandage on the back of Whist's head, or the equally impressive one across Diz's chest. So I hear you're staying. He asked Diz as a stiffly silent waiter brought their drinks.
Under some protest, yes, Diz said. Seems I've been summarily recalled to active duty and assigned to the Phobos as part of their brand new, quote, Zerg Compliance Ground Force Unit, unquote. ZCGFU. Makes for a hell of an acronym.
What are they complying with?
God only knows, Diz admitted. Whatever deal Valerian, Artanis, and Zagara came up with, I suppose. Plus, chasing down any Sialisks that got away, plus watching over the Adastra, plus keeping tabs on Abathur, etc., etc. Great fun.
Hey, it could be worse, Whist said. You could have been assigned as an ambassador or something. You'd probably have had to live on the ground then.
I probably will anyway, Diz said sourly.
And I assume you're joking about the ambassador thing. I want to fly, not talk for a living. Hardly my forte. Oh, I don't know, Whist mused. You put on a terrific show in there with Abathur. I'd hire you as prosecuting attorney any day.
Diz shrugged. Former criminal, remember? You sit through enough courtroom proceedings, you learn how it all works.
He picked up his drink and swirled it meditatively.
You gotta admit, though, no matter how you slice it, that was one hell of a day's work.
Sure was, Whist said, frowning.
It had been such a long day, he'd nearly forgotten that everything they'd done had indeed been crammed into that single sun-up to sundown period.
So who are we drinking to this time?
He asked, picking up his glass.
The ones Crookshank lost in his part of the one-day war?
First drink is to them, Diz agreed, nodding. Second drink? He gave Whist a lopsided smile. Second drink is to all the future comrades who won't die because of what we all did down there today.
Whist shook his head.
And I thought Reapers didn't have souls.
I thought Marines didn't have brains.
Still a fair chance we're both right, Whist pointed out.
That there is. Diz reached over the table and tapped Whist's glass with the edge of his.
Cheers, friend.
Cheers.
Krulu Sector Timeline. Circa 1500 AD. A group of rogue Protoss is exiled from the Protoss homeworld of Ire for refusing to join the Kala, a telepathic link shared by the entire race. These rogues, called the Dark Templar, cut their nerve cords to permanently sever their connection with the Kala. 2231. The government of Earth launches four supercarriers, the Argo, the Serengo, the Regan, and the Naglfar, to colonize hospitable planets mapped out in a nearby star system. Tens of thousands of passengers are placed in stasis for the journey, which is estimated to last 1 year. 2232. The supercarrier's linked navigation systems fail. The ships travel through space blindly, without a programmed destination. 2259. The ship's warp engines finally melt down. The supercarriers emerge into an unmapped region of the galaxy that will later be known as the Krulu Sector, and they make emergency landings on three planets, Umoja, Tarsonis, and Moria. 2323. The Terran Confederacy is founded on Tarsonis. 2475. Two corporate entities on Moria form an alliance, the Kelmorian Combine, to stand against Confederate intrusions on their territory. 2485. Tensions between the Confederacy and the Kelmorian Combine explode into open war. This conflict will later become known as the Guild Wars. 2489. The Confederacy declares victory in the Guild Wars. 2489. Umojan colonies form a military coalition called the Umojan Protectorate to ensure independence from Confederate tyranny. 2489. Senator Angus Mengsk and members of his family are brutally murdered by assassins after Mengsk dissents from Confederate leaders. His surviving son, Arcturus, openly rebels against the Confederacy from his homeworld of Korhal IV. 2491. The Confederacy decimates Korhal IV through nuclear bombardment. Arcturus Mengsk begins sustained guerrilla operations against the Confederacy. 2491. Mengsk's forces, the Sons of Korhal, capture Ghost Operative Sarah Kerrigan and secure her cooperation against the Confederacy. 2499. First contact. The Zerg, a previously unknown alien race, invade the planets of Chausara and Marsara. Shortly thereafter, a second unknown alien race, the Protoss, raises all life on Chausara. Marshal Jim Raynor, while leading the fight against the Zerg on Marsara, rebels against the Confederacy and joins with the Sons of Korhal. More planets openly revolt against the Confederacy. 2500. The Dominion rises. Arcturus Mengsk uses the Confederacy's own experimental technology to draw the Zerg Swarm to the capital world of Tarsonis. The planet is utterly destroyed. Mengsk also leaves his loyal operative Sarah Kerrigan behind to die, causing Jim Raynor to defect. Unbeknownst to Terran forces, Kerrigan is captured by the Zerg, not killed. Mengsk declares himself the ruler of a new nation, the Dominion,
he consolidates the scattered forces of the Confederacy under his command. The Protoss homeworld of Ire is overrun by the Zerg, but the Swarm's leader, the Overmind, is killed. 2500. New conflict. Forces from the United Earth Directorate, UED, Expeditionary Fleet arrive in the Kaprulu sector seeking to assert control over Terran planets. With the Overmind dead, Sarah Kerrigan, newly infested and empowered by the Zerg, seeks control of the Swarm. She allies briefly with Protoss and human factions to oppose UED forces. After securing her position as the uncontested ruler of the Zerg, Kerrigan turns on her allies. Retaliatory assaults against her stronghold on Char by Protoss, UED, and Dominion forces fail. Surviving UED forces scatter. None return to Earth. 2502. Dominion intelligence confirms that Artanis, a young Protoss military commander, is leading both the Ire Protoss and Dark Templar factions. 2504. Civil War. Jim Raynor redoubles his insurgent activities against the Dominion. Valerian Minsk, Arcturus' son, aids him in secret. Zerg forces begin to invade Dominion territory again. Civil unrest spreads across core Dominion worlds after allegations of Arcturus Minsk's excesses are made public. Armies, led by Valerian Minsk and General Horus Warfield, invade the Zerg planet of Char with assistance from Jim Raynor's forces. They neutralize and capture Sarah Kerrigan. 2505. The Swarm reemerges. Arcturus Minsk launches a raid on Valerian Minsk's stronghold in the Umojin territory. Jim Raynor is captured. Sarah Kerrigan escapes. Arcturus Minsk declares victory against the Zerg and enacts a brutal civil suppression regime to end unrest. Kerrigan reclaims control of the Zerg. The Swarm invades Korhal, cutting a direct path to Arcturus's palace and killing the Emperor. Zerg forces leave the planet immediately. Valerian Minsk becomes the Dominion's leader. He pledges to reform his father's policies and promote peace throughout the Kaprulu sector. 2506. War with Amon. The Protoss's Golden Armada launches an attack to retake Ire from the Zerg. During the invasion of Ire, the Protoss discover that the Zerg on the planet have been enslaved by the rogue Zelnaga, Amon. Amon then corrupts the Kala and gains control of all Protoss within the psionic link. The Dark Templar Zeratul severs Hierarch Artanis' nerve cords, destroying his connection to the Kala and allowing him to escape Amon's possession. But Zeratul is killed in the battle. Artanis liberates as many other Protoss as he can. They join up with the surviving Dark Templar and flee from Ire on the Arkship Spear of Adun. Artanis and his forces journey to Ulnar to learn the fate of the Zelnaga, the Protoss' ancient benefactors, and find that all but Amon have perished. While there, Artanis uncovers Amon's plan to use the Protoss and the Overmind's remains to forge a new host body. If Amon succeeds, all life in the universe will be destroyed. Using an ancient Zelnaga relic known as the Keystone, Artanis drives Amon from the Kala, and the formerly enslaved Protoss sever their nerve cords to ensure their freedom. Artanis and his forces retake Ire. Amon is banished to the void. 2508. Aftermath. Kerrigan, Jim Raynor, Artanis, the Broodmother Zagara, and their forces enter the void to attempt to defeat Amon once and for all. Kerrigan absorbs the remaining power of a Zelnaga, becoming Zelnaga herself. She gives Zagara command of the Swarm. Then, with the aid of her allies, Kerrigan destroys Amon, disappearing shortly afterward. Raynor also disappears sometime after the battle. The Terrans, the Protoss, and the Zerg end hostilities with one another. Valerian Minsk begins open elections in the Dominion. Zagara takes control of the systems near Char for the Zerg Swarm.
This is Christopher Ryan Grant. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of StarCraft Evolution by Timothy Zahn. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2016 by Blizzard Entertainment, Inc. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.